good evening and welcome to the Royal Academy of Arts. My name is Amy Blewett and I'm the Events and Lectures Coordinator here. Jonathan Yeo is perhaps the best known for his iconic images of Dennis Hopper, Sienna Miller, Erin O'Connor, Tony Blair, Damien Hirst and Malala Yousafzai. His recent exhibitions include a landmark show at the National Portrait Gallery in London in 2013, followed by a mid-career retrospective at the Lowry in Manchester. His solo show, Jonathan Yeo Portraits, has just opened at the Lang Art Gallery in Newcastle and runs until February. It includes several major new works of Lily Cole, the Duchess of Cornwall, and a self-portrait titled Photo Booth Selfie. Joining him tonight in conversation is the RA's Director of Artistic Programmes, Tim Marlowe.
I take full responsibility, but, and obviously all the credit if it's good and no credit if it's not, but for inviting Jonathan to talk about portraiture. But he wasn't invited as a Moroni expert or scholar, and this is not an evening that will be a forensic analysis of Moroni. But it is really interesting to get a contemporary portrait painter's view, both of his work and the world in which we now are and where portraiture may be going in the future, but also using Moroni as a springboard. So having just been through the exhibition with Johnny, and he spent some time up there, I thought I'd put you on the spot, Johnny, with one or two Moroni works, and just talk about one or two issues. The first is this claim that is made art historically, that I certainly go along with, about psychological realism and so on in Moroni, because in the context of 16th century Western art, he has this intense realism. How does that resonate with you, though, now, sitting here and having looked at these kinds of works?
Well, I'm glad we are going deep into Moroni from the start. I did get a message from Tim the other day saying, don't worry about knowing too much about it. In fact, don't even worry about seeing the show if you don't want to. We won't talk about, you know, it's really, we just want a contemporary perspective. And it did just occur to me on the way over here that maybe this was a nice little bluff to set it up. But no, I'm sure you wouldn't do that. It's interesting. We were just saying this thing where I hadn't seen his work before this show, really. I mean, I've come across it occasionally, but never really thought about it. I don't even really remember seeing any, certainly not that up close, certainly not the ones you've chosen in this show, which are in great condition.
You might have seen this one at the National.
Exactly. That's the one that sort of looks, it's actually sort of slightly faded and it slightly looks different to the other ones in the room. But yes, the sort of, but apart from that one, I don't remember seeing the others. You often get shows which are built up as the great undiscovered master or forgotten painter, you know, art history is left behind. Disappointed when you actually see it, because it's just a way of, I think, luring people in. It's certainly the case with this show. It's amazing being there, and that the reproductions in the catalogue and in the papers and everywhere don't do justice at all to the actual work, which is so luminous and fresh and sort of immediate. I've forgotten your question, but it was something to do with the sort of
whether it resonates with psychological naturalism, I think. But so, incidentally, what we wanted, I wanted your fresh eye. That's why I said I didn't expect you to look at it. But of course, that's what we're getting now. People look for the contemporary in the past to a certain extent, and I'm interested in how much the past informs the contemporary in you, which we come on to in a minute. But you made the point upstairs that this man did seem of his time, but also of our time. So there was a kind of timelessness about him.
Yes, I think superficially, I thought it was just the facial hair that made it look like he could have been affecting a similar pose in Hoxton Square last week. If you took away the outfit and replaced it with a sort of hipster thing, so it's the face and the whiskers and the, yeah, obviously fashions come in cycles in art and in clothes and everything, but actually, what's interesting is that I think it doesn't, you know, this is a posed picture. They all are. They're people who are aware of being, they're about to have their painting done. They're thinking about how they're going to come across. But their body language in all the pictures is so natural. And the way the surface of the skin, the way the eyes communicate very directly, it does feel like there are living, breathing people in the room with you. and now that's not necessarily a, a key criteria of a great painter. In fact, in a funny way, we tend to remember portraitists for their styles, for their almost how caricatured they are, because of how extreme the style was, or because of a recognizable characteristic that made them less like real people in a way. And so, for me, it was very interesting. I mean, particularly that room of the not so much the religious stuff, not so much the early stuff, but that room of the commissioned portraits, the room afterwards with the later works, which feel like they were things that he'd chosen to do, and were less influenced by the sort of stylistic sort of touches of the time, the backgrounds, the sort of neoclassical sort of things he probably was. There was the general trends at the time. Once he lost all that, you really felt it. So that was the point. It's just that this, if you took away the outfit and the silly background, it could have been done last week.
Technically, do you find this artist remarkable? Do you think it's extraordinary he's not better known? Or as a technically gifted painter, does it just look accomplished?
It's tricky to sort of compare things on an even field, because obviously a lot of work from that period has been damaged, or the pigments have faded and have been badly restored. Obviously your curator's chosen a very good selection of ones in great condition. The technique is extraordinary. And what's interesting is it seems to be very consistent. I don't know if the backgrounds don't seem quite as well painted, but the clothes and the face, the skin tones, the hands are beautifully done. I mean, they're almost sort of distractingly so. It's almost like, they're dazzling, and that in a way distracts you from the fact that they're also very, very sensitive character studies. We were talking just now about the fact there's only one drawing in there, he pointed out, and the feeling is that maybe he didn't do preparatory studies and work the pictures up from that like a lot of artists would have done at the time. And I wondered if that wasn't part of it. I mean, the fact that he's probably gone straight in and immediately painted what he saw, rather than done a sort of sketch and then taken that back to a studio and filled the rest in from his memory or in the artist's sort of like normal style, and so the overall look of the work would have been much more standardized. Each one feels very different. There's no sort of formula to the process or the works generally. I mean, that stands out. I can't think of any other artists like that whose work, where each one seems to have such a strong personality of its own from that sort of period at all.
Interestingly enough, this is an image of a woman. Let's just see this rather extraordinary portrait as well, with the most pronounced codpiece, I think, in the 16th century. I'm flippant to a certain extent, but I want to throw a point that Jonathan Jones made recently. Jonathan Jones, in a lecture here and in his Guardian reviews, went off very deeply at a tangent about Moroni's depictions of men and women. He said that they're much more intimate, he's much more sensual and in love with the male physiognomy, the male form, than he is the female. And then he said that he felt there was an incredible homoerotic underpinning or tension. Now, there's no evidence, and I just don't see that. I mean, but I'm curious that Jonathan feels that strongly about it, and he's looked a lot at Moroni. And I'm curious about what your response is, not necessarily to that, but the intimacy with which he depicts men and women. Is there a difference? Is there a fundamental difference in the way that he approaches men and women?
It's interesting, until you mentioned that before, I hadn't picked up on it. But then you look back and it's interesting. I mean, obviously, Jonathan's on the he's looking for trouble and an angle. But it's a fun thing. And there were certainly pictures like that one, which are would sort of illustrate that argument very well. I mean, that one, you do feel the kind of sort of thrusting. It's one of the few pictures in there where you feel the sort of sitter's really trying to lead the artist into a certain kind of...
The pedestal.
Exactly. He's very pleased with himself. It's interesting that in the room of all the kind of commissioned work, actually none of them feel the sort of the usual grandeur and pomposity and sort of self-satisfied pose and personality that you associate with a lot of the sort of that kind of commissioned work of that sort of era, of any era, really. They feel almost a bit vulnerable. I mean, that guy doesn't seem too vulnerable at all, except for the, obviously, in case of the thing that's sticking out. It does seem like, looking back, though, that you realize actually all the women in the portraits, none of them are very sexy. There's no sort of flirtation. There's no kind of sense of attraction. I didn't find that. I don't think it was so with the men either. Well, exactly. I didn't look like he was trying to rip her dress off, really. But the they feel this just seems like a sort of distance. It feels like he's got a detached. He's obviously connecting with them enough that they are being themselves, but he's not kind of. There isn't a sort of tension or chemistry there.
Which brings me to ask about your own approach to men and women. I mean, we'll talk about individuals in a minute. I've got some examples of your work, but does sexual tension or the tension in personality or gender difference and so on, does that play a part? I mean, if you find somebody attractive, is it something you have to work with or against, or do you just try and banish all thoughts from your mind and you become monastic as a painter? I mean, in the way that you are in the studio.
It's hard to know, because I've been doing the same thing for a long time. I mean, you sat for me not that long ago, so you probably could tell me about the sexual tension in the room at the time.
I actually fell asleep, so it was kind of post-coital. Yeah.
I was using some of my best material as well. I was disappointed with that. It's actually... it tends to be people over the age of about 80 normally who fall asleep in the middle of the city. But I'm glad you felt relaxed enough, obviously, in my company that you could do that. Each one's different. I mean, that's the fun of it. And that's why I relate to this painter, really, is that you don't get the sense he's gone in with an agenda with any of the pictures. And I think whenever you make the mistake of trying to prejudge a situation, whether it's what someone's going to be like, how you're going to get on with them, what kind of painting you're going to do, it's always a mistake, because all that happens is you get into it and then have to stop and start again when you realise what's actually going on.
I think that's really interesting, that your view of Moroni is that he doesn't paint Moronis, he paints people. And that could be one of the reasons why he hasn't been as revered, because it's not a discernible or immediately recognisable style. It's not signature. I think it's really interesting. I think the other thing about him is the provincial charge. You know, he's working in Bergamo. Bergamo is on the very fringes of the Venetian Republic, quite close to, you know, the Lombardy, Milan, and so on, and there's political and religious and tensions and military tensions, but it's out on a limb. And of course, you're working in a completely different milieu, which is contemporary London, and it is a place with great cultural momentum. So I suppose, in a sense, that's a gift to a portrait painter, because a lot of great people, I don't just mean in terms of great and good, but I do mean that as well, but there's a lot of interesting people passing through this town.
Yeah, well, yes. So geographically, London's great because everyone comes here sooner or later, and so you don't have quite the same issue. I sometimes would go travel to people, but it's quite useful to be able to get them into the studio as well, because you can tend to light it better and set it up better, and they feel a bit more vulnerable there as well. Absolutely, London's a great place for seeing a cross section of kind of global troublemakers and eccentrics. It's an interesting thing. I mean, obviously, before photography came along, these guys had a job. A portrait painter was not just an artist; they were had a historical job. They had to record there was no other way of recording what these people looked like, and that was an important thing. Photography made, obviously, that all that's redundant, and I think for a long time it seemed anachronistic, and portraiture became a vehicle for artists to experiment with their styles or sort of try things out or subvert the sort of conventions of representation. It's changed. I mean, we've talked about this before, but it was changing anyway, I think, in the last few years with digital manipulation, the sense that thing of photography as historical document that can't be argued with, the camera never lies, has changed anyway in recent years, because I think we understand that images are sort of photoshopped and changed. And then much more recently, I mean, the thing I'm interested in at the moment is how much the way in which we all take pictures of ourselves now on camera phones, and is teaching. I'm aware that, you know, my kids will know how to, you know, already learning how to light things best. You know, what, when they're looking at pictures of their friends on Instagram or whatever it is, they're sort of decoding what they're trying to, you know, what's in the background, what they're trying to say about themselves. You know, things which you might have learned as a painter, but, you know, at art school or when you were an art history student, you know, 10, 15 years later, if at all, people are sort of learning. It's a very early age, and using. So we're becoming sort of experts at reading and manipulating portraits.
Well, let me go back, go forward in the images, but go back. So this is, in some ways, a rite of passage. It's one of your earliest portraits, done in 93. Trevor Huddleston, Bishop Trevor Huddleston, Bishop of Stepney, but a great figure in South Africa and the sort of freedom struggles there. What made you want to be, or what made you become, a portrait painter? And then let's talk specifically about this as well in the context of that.
Well, very quickly, because I probably bored everyone about it before, but I didn't go to art school. I did used to draw a lot at school, often when I wasn't supposed to, and one of the things I liked doing, because I found it interesting and it would make people laugh, was to draw caricatures, often of the teachers in the back of class. And at the time, obviously, I used to get told off for that, and my parents are here, probably can
remember
the number of times they've had to sort of read reports saying, you know, if only he'd stop doodling, he might actually pass the exams. But actually, in retrospect, then also because later on, when I left school and was wondering what to do, it was exactly that time when painting was seen as so out of fashion that art schools had stopped really bothering to teach it, with one or two exceptions. But it was really, there was a genuine debate. I mean, you remember it was about whether painting would come back at all. So I knew I wanted to paint. I didn't know if there was a use for it or how to get into it. And suddenly my friends who went to art school weren't being taught that. So I tried to learn it for myself. I mean, sort of failed miserably at first and did very badly at it. But eventually, I think, sort of got the hang of it enough. And this one was important just because it was the first time someone else had asked me to do a portrait. And so it was a commission in that sense. I don't think any money changed hands, but it was suddenly, he was someone who I knew through my dad and I'd met, and it was that crucial time when I was trying to decide what to do in life. I was ill at the time as well. I think that sort of serious illness gives you a sort of, you know, it's a wake-up call, but also makes you a bit more stubborn and focused in a way. I think all those things converging, this thing, this was the first time I tried to do a painted portrait where, and not tried it to, you know, to be natural, real, photographic, but just done something fast when they were sitting in front of me. And it was a sudden sort of light switching on. It was, you know, suddenly, actually, if you get someone interesting, you're sort of channeling your sort of instinct about them, and this sort of style sort of follows that. And it made me very excited about doing it. And luckily, also, he showed it to a lot of people. And so I just got enough work from that to keep going.
When you said you were largely self-taught, did you teach yourself mainly by trying to do it, or did you spend a lot of time looking at portraiture and the old masters in particular?
I spent a lot of time looking at things and trying to copy them. They tended to, some of them were old masters, but it was just as much because we lived near the Tate, as it was then, now Tate Britain. And so it tended to be, you know, what was in their collection and all what happened to be on shows. So you can probably see the point in my early work when there was a big Picasso show there because everything went sort of cubist. And, you know, it really was as simple as that. You think, well, really, it doesn't look that hard to do it. And sometimes you copy it and find it wasn't that hard to do it. And obviously other times it was, you know, a lot harder than you thought. But by trying to force yourself to work out what people were doing technique-wise and also you know, why they were doing things and why they were choosing the scale for things, you just gradually, I guess, built up an armory of different styles, which, you know, fused a bit. I mean, you can still see it in this one, really, that sort of early interest in the sort of, you know, kind of cubism and futurism and that sort of thing.
The cubist cleric, yeah.
Yeah. So that's how it started, really. And then by getting a few commissions for portraits, I never imagined I'd be a portrait painter. I certainly didn't see that as a sort of possibility, but I enjoyed doing it. So I thought, I'll do this while I'm waiting to see what I do want to do. And meanwhile, I'm getting paid by people but through commissions to learn how to do it rather than have to go and get a proper job. So this is okay.
Do you feel now that you're... Do you still feel that you're working towards total artistic freedom and that the commission is something you'd like to stop? Or is it still, apart from the practicalities of needing to earn a living, it's a very good way of earning a living, it gives you access to the kinds of people you might not otherwise get access to?
That's a very good question. It's complicated. I know some artists absolutely hate the idea and the constraints or the implication that they are prostituting themselves somehow by doing something where, and they know where it's going, and then somehow that person can sort of, you know, dictate the terms of it. I think that as long as people don't expect you to be doing something in a certain way because of them, to suit their wishes, then it's an interesting thing. I mean, yes, I slightly prefer not to do commissions, partly because I like to have the freedom to decide what to do with the picture afterwards myself. I liked the idea that it's not just going to go straight from the studio to someone's wall, but it's going to have a life of its own. Obviously, I've been doing portrait shows in the last couple of years where I've deliberately chosen a wide variety of subjects that interest me, from creative worlds, political worlds. And I think because they're ones that I approached, it kind of gave me the freedom to sort of do it in any way I wanted. Not that I wouldn't have had that anyway, but I think it feels slightly different. But your last point is right too, which is that there are one or two people who, you know, it's only by doing a commission in the past that I've been able to paint. I mean, I've been lucky to paint all kinds of people, but certainly some with quite busy jobs, prime ministers and people who probably wouldn't take the afternoon off to be your life model if the picture wasn't for a particular purpose afterwards. So, you know, it's a sort of weighing up the sort of balance between, you know, the constraints of it and the, you know, access you get to someone. But it is getting easier now. I think the sort of and most of the recent ones have been done on my initiation.
Let's look at a wonderful, I think, mid-period in your life so far, commission. Because, I mean, you mentioned your parents, and your father's here, and it does seem to me very significant that growing up in a political household, you know, your father was a cabinet minister, you must have had a perspective, however subconscious, but it must have been conscious too, about power politics, politicians as individuals, as well as figureheads and so on. And it's difficult to unravel exactly how that impacts on the work, but it must give you, in a sense, a perspective that other portraitists don't necessarily have. But also, you applied some kind of conceptual framework, which I think is one of the other things that makes this work so interesting, to a commission that you were asked to do during the 2001 election. Explain the commission.
Well, this came about because... It actually came about because Tony Blair had been in power for several years, had been refusing to have his portrait painted for anyone, House of Commons, National Portrait Gallery. And this was actually an idea came up by brilliant Tony Banks, who was then running the House of Commons Art Collection, as a way of getting around that. He decided to sort of pretend to Blair that there was this tradition of having an election artist on the campaign, and that, you know, basically, you know, by kind of getting William Hague and Charles Kennedy in on to agree to do it first. I think literally just ran into him in the sort of House of Commons lobby one evening and said, look, this is happening, that's okay, isn't it? And Blair sort of agreed to it without really thinking it through. So that was an excuse to do a painting of him at all, and which had become a bit of a kind of general game in the sort of portrait business at that time. The problem with it was that now I had to do it. Banks asked me to do it, if I could do it, under the constraints of, you know, not doing it in the studio, following them around on the election for 5 weeks and making something up around
that. So like
an
embedded journalist?
Yes, somewhere between that and a sort of Hogarthian, you know, kind of... and I think, yes, exactly. Well, you sort of became an embedded journalist. That's one of the interesting things, is how much you learn about what's actually going on, and how at that time, you know, I would sort of spend literally alternate days with the different campaigns, and you would be in the sort of bus, often with blacked out windows, with all these journalists who've been following these guys around for weeks on end. And there was a sort of Stockholm syndrome gradually takes hold over the course of it. The Kickstarter campaign, everyone was very cynical about everything. By the end, they were just sort of towing the kind of line of whatever they were given that day in order to, you know, to receive some scraps of food at the end of it. It's a strange experience going on that sort of campaign as an outsider, but very interesting too. And I was often alongside Steve Bell, you know, the brilliant Guardian cartoonist, who doing sort of the same thing, but not. I mean, because he can caricature these guys in seconds because he's been doing it for a while. But what they had to do was, the cartoonists have to represent, you know, what you feel about those personalities you don't know, but you have a whole view of them that day, summarize the general mood, all the kind of current references. As a painter, you've got to do something which is going to ring true 10, 20, 50, 100 years later, by which time you'll know a lot more about what was actually going on. And for that, all you've got to go on is the personality. And if you work, I feel the ones that work well are the ones where you work it out. But yes, sorry, I'm rambling. The point you were making is that it was about the election. I liked the idea of bringing a conceptual thing into it. And so, because they had to be straight portraits on the one hand, but the different size pictures, you can just about see it there. They're sort of broken into three different sort of widths according to how many votes they got, and therefore how much they deserve to be part of it. And so proportional representation, which was another kind of theme that was going around at the time, was a little joke as well. I mean, it was a gentle thing, but it was a way of introducing a sort of a wider idea into what otherwise these ones are dead straight, you know, as sort of straightforward, very realist portraits as I have ever used to do.
How long? I mean, I know you were with them on the bus, but how long did you get with them sitting still while you actually tried to paint?
Not at all, really. I mean, there were times when I was allowed into quite small meetings, but I was always observing, and sometimes even one-on-one. You know, at the end of the day, sometimes they sort of, you know, if they'd had a busy day and felt it was going well, you know, Blair a few times would sort of take pity on me and then invite me for a cup of tea at the back of the bus and the chat and to let me do a bit of drawing. But then, you know, you're in the back of a bus going down a motorway, you give it a bump and pencil goes all across it and you ruin it, and so you start again. So it's not a great way of actually working, but it is an interesting way of getting to see a bit of your subject in all states. I never really felt with any of them that they were ever being fully themselves, because they were so used to doing the public job and then doing the sort of fake matey thing with the journalists behind the scenes that I'd never really felt that. And, you know, I don't think you can in that job switch off completely. So it was an interesting experience, but I don't feel. I think that tells the story of what was going on in that election. You've got Blair in sort of messiah mode, hey, knowing he's going to lose. Charles Kennedy not really enjoying any of it and sort of was off the booze for the campaign as well, which wasn't helping. And I think, you know, it was what was going on, but this is as far away from the rest of... I mean, this is the least like Moroni and least like the sort of true under-the-skin character depictions of any of my work in a way.
And partly because you had to make drawings. You weren't spending time with them. Okay, let's move on, because it's a wonderful comparison. So here is Blair 6 years later, where what a great comparison with what 6 years in power does for you. Was he a willing sitter because of the relationship you developed with him before?
Possibly, yes. I mean, I think that he was pretty reassured that, you know, I didn't have another agenda at that stage. The thing also, I mean, there were so many things I would, you know, early on, it's very difficult to do a painting of someone who's going into power, going into a job where they're going to be doing something where they'll be defined by what happens to them. We don't know what that is yet. In his case, in 2001, you wouldn't have predicted that he was going to be defined by the foreign policy decisions and never escape that. But even by 2007, which was at the end of his term, you sort of did know by then. And also by then, I think he was just, you know, he didn't care quite as much. He wasn't sort of trying to sort of exert control over every aspect of life. And so this, I think, again, it took a while to persuade him to come to the studio, but he did eventually. But I was so aware of not of needing to reference the sort of some of his story, but not wanting to do it in a heavy-handed way, or you know, make it overly simplistic or trite, or have big distracting sort of war scenes going on, or you know, I couldn't work out what it was. I knew it had to be something, and then he came in because it was November, you know, it was this time of year, and had the poppy on. And he was just about to take it off. He said, "Oh, I'll take this off." No, dude, maybe not yet. And although I didn't know for sure at that point that I'd use that, it just was like, actually, that would do. That might just do by itself. And in a way, I think it's nice because of the simplicity of it. It's such an immediately recognisable symbol.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wound. But it's also a symbol of war, dead. I mean, it was a gift, wasn't it? It was the New Labour's rose, I suppose, turned into a symbol of death. It makes sense. I mean, it's such a gift, but its use. So in such an accomplished way here. But it makes sense of a brilliantly flippant remark you made earlier as we were talking to Moroni, and you said all that neoclassical rubbish in the background. But I was thinking, wow. But I think what you meant was the trappings of allegory and so on. Whereas in the contemporary world, Blair, almost overcome by the kind of miasma of void, you know, I mean, I tried to interpret this in terms of existential crisis. I remember one time writing about your work. But the point is, the allegorical trappings are in the poppy, aren't they?
Yes,
that, it does it all
exactly.
for you.
Yes, exactly. And I think I was being glib about Moroni just because I felt they were things he'd borrowed from other people rather than was particular to the subject. I felt that was the one thing that slightly jars in that room of paintings, whereas everything else, the way they're standing, the clothes, the colours, the personality, everything else clearly is key to that person, and nothing's sort of out of balance. And the danger with these things is I spent ages trying to compose it and work out where the head and the poppy should be and how red it should be, because you need it to be very powerfully there, but still not completely take your attention away from his face, which is still the most interesting thing. By which time, I also learned thought a lot about how to light it, and rather than do it flat from the front like I'd had to do in the last one, I was able to give it a slightly more Hollywood a bit of more drama to it. And I think that is interesting about him. He is part Hollywood star, part war criminal, part there's so much going on there. It's a difficult thing, but yes, symbolism. I think I took a long time to kind of be comfortable using symbolism because I was worried it would seem trite and heavy-handed.
Well, in a way, it's a non-judgmental painting, but there's subtly it makes the points you've just made. But this is definitely a partisan portrait that you did of George Bush in 2007, where people initially seeing it, they think it's a kind of collaged post-cubist image of Bush, which it is. But if you look closely, his face is made up of pornography. What prompted you to, I say, pick on Bush? I think that's probably not the right term. I think he can manage some artistic caricatures. But what motive? I mean, it makes sense to me. Religious fundamentalism in America, Bush's conservative party values being attacked. But it's odd that you suddenly, out of the blue, should be taking this kind of approach. Why? What prompted it? Was it made out of anger?
It wasn't anger. It was, I think, because it started off as a commission, and so I'd been having to think about how I'd do someone who was clearly very unpopular even this day. I think the actual commission was about 03, 04, just before he was re-elected. And they made me do all kinds of things and send over examples of how it might look. And so I had to do something which I wouldn't normally do, which is do some studies of based on kind of press photos and that sort of thing. And just there was just a bit more, there was general suspicion. It was all war on terror. Needed to know all about your family background. Where you were born, where your parents were born, where it's just so much security. It was just all a big effort. And so then when they said, "Oh, actually, when didn't happen," I was a bit annoyed about it. But I also had all this material, so I was like, "Oh, I'll use it somehow." It was playful rather than angry. I had already had this niggling worry that, he's such an unpopular politician everywhere in the world. The reports I got was he's a very charming and charismatic person. There was always my worry that I might have gone there and liked him, and then had the dilemma of having to sort of what to show in the picture. anyway, that didn't happen. This did. I thought that collage would be a fun extension of the slightly painterly cubist work anyway, and it would be an easy thing to do. To do it out of pornography was an obvious thing. You know, I justified it in terms of skin tones, because you've obviously got to find them all there. And it's playful. Yeah, people... I think that if it's effective because it looks like a painting from a distance. There's a delayed reaction. Early on, it was looking too like a painting, so I had to put one or two bits of more obvious detail in so that people would then go in to check what they were and then realise. The idea was just to do it as an experiment, and if it worked, then I actually thought I might try and send it over to them anyway and say, well, here's the picture. I started it, so I might as well finish and see if they notice. I sort of imagine they might even put it on the wall, and it would sit there for a while without, you know, and it would be a nice little sort of quiet little sort of joke to myself. But that didn't happen. The thing took much longer than I expected anyway. I almost gave up on it, but I started to see how well it was working, and actually that you could be as precise with bits of paper if you could be bothered to thumb through enough bloody magazines to find the right colour and you know, with whatever detail you needed. So it was an interesting thing, and because of it being made of this material, which is so cheap and disposable and not a painting, it was interesting how people's relationship with the work could dramatically change when they realised it wasn't a painting, it was something else. So there's that sort of... there were so many aspects of it which interested me, and so it led on to other work. But they were all based on people who were... who were not people I hadn't met. So this was all based on people's reputations, and there were various others that followed. I did Hugh Hefner and Sigmund Freud and Paris Hilton and various others. I've just done the last one, which I started years ago, actually. I've had to give up on these, mostly because you can't buy the magazines anymore. You know, the iPad has killed porn mags.
Matt, you'd need. I think you'd killed the market. But and who is the last one?
It's actually going to be on a show next week, but it's Silvio Berlusconi, which was started some years ago when he was a bit more... in the public eye, but I didn't quite have the energy or reason to finish it. But yes, and I'm afraid it's called Bunga Bunga, and it's actually got a lot more detail than this one on it.
Berlusconi is probably the sitter that wouldn't mind. I mean, in a way, does history relate what Bush's response to this was, or was there a deafening silence when the work was finished?
There were responses from Republican spokesmen, which were very po-faced and we don't see what's funny about this, or why would anyone want to do this, and that kind of thing. I mean, I think the reality is that he's obviously a very skillful politician. He won two elections. He probably knows when to comment on things and when not to. I suspect also he'd have probably found it funny, actually, as you said, sort of, I thought at the start. We didn't know then that he was an artist himself, which...
We still don't, actually. Have you seen the paintings?
Yeah, they're terrible. I happen to be in Dallas when they were on. They're mesmerizingly bad, I'm happy to say. But there didn't seem to be a unanimous verdict at all, judging by the respectful crowds going through the gallery.
Here's the final final one of our contemporary politics selections. There's a handful more, but Malala Yousafzai is a very prescient portrait, because she's just won the Nobel Peace Prize, and you worked with her before. But was this a difficult painting to get access to? I mean, it was a difficult subject, rather, to get access to.
I think probably yes. I mean, it was this amazing coincidence. It was at a time when I was doing the show at the National Portrait Gallery and trying to decide what to put in it. They, you know, given me the sort of freedom to choose the subjects I wanted to represent, other than a few older ones they wanted to include. So it was I just basically made a wish list of anyone who was interesting to me at that time, not expecting many of them to say yes to it. Certainly least of all, Malala, who was just come out of hospital at that time. It was a fortunate thing that they saw it, and whoever advises her, a brilliant bunch of people who advise her. Obviously, I would say they're brilliant. They suggested she did this, but it was a lovely thing, because actually that was such an extraordinary time in her life, which is so fragile and vulnerable, and yet becoming so massively well known. And And as a totemic figure as well. You know, I think, you know, so much was being projected onto her. She was representing so many different things to different people. She's, you know, as hated as she is admired in different parts of the world, ridiculous as it seems. And it was interesting. For me, what was interesting was, because I'd done the political portraits earlier on and was obviously associated with politics, there to do someone who represented a new kind, it's a different, someone who had been pulled into politics, had been had a political role imposed on her. I did Doreen Lawrence was the other one. I thought that was a similar thing. There's a sort of, you know, the world's changing, way of communication's changing. There's a sort of general sense that sort of old political structures don't work as well anymore, and maybe not keeping up with sort of technology either. So there isn't some sort of clever sort of, yeah, obviously I'm not doing Russell Brand and sort of explain what the solution to everything is, but I think it's interesting seeing that sort of the people who are becoming, you know, you can become a massive, much more powerful, influential person by not going into it sometimes in the normal way.
It's interesting you said people do project onto her in a way, but as a campaigner for, you know, for women's rights or education, the blogs that she did, the, you know, the attack, the life-threatening assassination attempt or being shot, did you find her reserved and sort of quietly steely, or was she quite animated and open in the times that you had her sitting for you? I mean, she strikes me from afar as an incredibly strong person, but fairly discreet and.
I'd read about her before she was shot, because she was famous as doing this blog as a 13-year-old. I hadn't really sort of studied it, but then I looked back afterwards and saw what she was also interviewed. She was very, very communicative and energetic and passionate. Obviously, she was in a very shaky state when I first met her. Each time, she's got progressively more back, not quite back to how she was before, but certainly more sort of sure of herself. And it's a very interesting thing. It seemed like she was a very fragile person the first time. Once she got used to me being around and I got her talking, she was so focused. I mean, it was clearly somebody who had an eye on history. She's got a sort of great sense of her role in the world. And this was, you know, before she was even 16, before I think they'd really decided what they were going to do with, you know, her. But I think even then, she said something to me about how, what an amazingly counterproductive thing it was, you know, by sort of trying to use violence to shut up a local annoying opponent of, you know, the regime. They made her infinitely more powerful. She had a great perspective on things. And so she's obviously going to she expects to do it for a long time. And she has this, because she moves slowly now and has this sort of very unusual sort of look and presence, it's amazing how when she does walk into a room, she has this extraordinary sort of presence. It wasn't there when I first met her, but seeing her in public now, I think, is a very interesting thing.
Why this particular pose?
The pose was just because, obviously, the reason we know of her and the reason she was, you know, they tried to shut her up was because she was just campaigning for girls to be educated at all under the Taliban regime in northern Pakistan where she lived. And it was so powerful then, and she was obviously being threatened. And the school was gradually losing pupils because of the threats. She was one of the last ones to use it. Anyway, it just seemed like a simple device to have her doing the thing that they were trying to stop her doing, and the thing which is now using her foundation, using her energy and money to make happen for kids generally in parts of the world, and not just locally to her, but sort of everywhere. It's becoming a much wider thing.
But this is something you asked her to do, or you asked her how she'd like to be portrayed? I mean, I just wonder how complicit she was, or how much it's a conversation.
Her name, the text just says, has the name Malala Maiwand, which is the historical figure she was named after, who is the one who, funny enough, her dad, he was very brilliant and quite sort of, it was a sort of, ran a charity for sort of education before, so obviously it's an influence on her, but much less than I expected. he'd named her after this figure who was famous for having led the rebellion against the British in whatever it was, the 1890s. And so it was a famous figure there because of that. Immediately sort of humorously saw the irony of the fact that it was the British who'd managed to like save her life and set her up here. But there's the I think he, out of all the family, had always imagined her as having a sort of destiny. And so it is an interesting thing. I mean, the sort of subtext, I suppose, is you know, here's someone who, you know, has been forced into a situation and has huge expectation, actually had quite a lot before she even was in that situation. You sort of worry, maybe, I was worried beforehand that there was some manipulation going on, that something behind her was maybe, you know, pulling the strings and pushing it. But I didn't feel that at all. I felt it's absolutely who she is. And actually, you know, amazing to turn things around and make, you know, use it to such an advantage.
Artists, Damien Hirst, Grayson Perry. I wonder whether, because of your sensitivity to or empathy with what they do, or, and perhaps it's symbiotic or sympathetic at least when they're sitting for you, I wonder whether there are different challenges in depicting artists, in portraying artists, or whether they become just another human being who does certain things.
I mean, I think for me, having not done sort of like years at art school and had a background, a community of artists, kind of contemporaries who I sort of grew up with, I've come a bit later to it. I always, and these guys, both Damien and Grace, the people whose work I admired well before I met them. It is interesting about any other artists, even when, and I think almost especially when they do things which are quite different from what you do. I mean, I think that there's an extra pressure because you feel they are going to be reading it in a much more precise way. But it's very, and in Damien's case, I wanted to get across the sort of way he's seen, get across the bit of the humour, but also I thought it'd be interesting to sort of reference what he did in some way, but in an unusual way. Obviously, he's not someone who works standing at an easel. This outfit is that, which I quite like the sort of mad ambiguity of it, because
Well, it looks like something out of an Alan Jones painting, but it's not. It's the formaldehyde suit, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So that's what he used to actually use to get into the tanks and make the work. The gas mask, the whole gear looks a bit, you know, and the pose was deliberate to make him look a bit deranged, a bit like a paramilitary. So there was a bit of ambiguity before you start. Then you have to read the rest of it, hopefully, and work it out. There's still the ambiguity, I hope, that of whether he's in the tank because he's making something or has been made into one of his own exhibits. Obviously, the expression kind of gives away that he's in on the joke, but it's still, it's a big painting. We took a lot of time over it. It took me a long time to work out how to do it, but it gave us time to sort of think about lots of things and trying to get the sense of, you know, he's obviously a big Bacon fan. I've always liked the Velázquez version, the sort of like idea of the sort of Pope's pose, sort of lording it over everyone. Certainly when I was I was a few years younger than him, and so he was already a big figure in the art world and seen as sort of, you know, an overlord almost. And I think that I wanted to get all that into it, but also the fact that, you know, you probably know him better than me, but he's such a playful personality, and there are very few things where he's not one step ahead of you on the joke anyway.
He's also, he's also a very curious individual. And when I wasn't sleeping when I sat for you, I was very curious about what you were doing. I mean, I was sort of looking, watching you intently, watching me or painting, and then we just got talking and then off it went. But I remember asking you whether or not you wanted me to see what you'd done at the end of a sitting or not, because I was curious as to what you... And you said, well, maybe better not later. So I said, fine, and I hadn't seen it. I wonder with Damien whether he was up and down constantly looking at what you were doing. As a guess, he would be quite curious. Or did he sit back and wait only till you'd finished it?
It's a funny thing, actually. I think possibly like you and he, I think people who are interested in the process are not so worried at that stage about how they're being made to look. I mean, some people come and the main concern is whether you've made them look, you know, kind, not, you know, clever, old, young. You know, people have got their own preoccupations about what they're hoping to see. I think for him and Grayson, probably part of the interest and the reason they kind of obviously made time to do it when they didn't have to was because they're people who make things, they're curious about my technique, and I sort of saw both of them at different stages in different ways, you know, kind of very sort of gently asked questions about the sort of technique and what I was doing certain things for. I mean, Damon's endlessly curious. I think that was probably the more, I was much more aware of that, that they were interested in what, how it was being made and, you know, how these things came about. I don't remember either of them really needing to sort of, to kind of see the picture. Almost, they were, and it's funny seeing Grayson go through the same experience when he did that TV series recently about portraiture, and it was a very brilliant and precise summary of the state of contemporary portraiture and actually the experience of doing it. But I loved it when he said, you saw him in the gallery at the end of one of the programs saying how nervous he was, because actually he'd gone into it thinking it was all only going to be about how truthful the thing was. But actually he did also want the subject to, if not like it, at least recognize themselves in it. And there is that thing, yeah, I think you sort of, well, anyway, I don't feel, I mean, some people worry about it. It's always like a sort of, I felt with both of them, there's a slight nervousness that builds up if you don't look at a picture about, you know, because in case you don't like it, there's this awkwardness. You build up such a rapport with whoever it is.
Nervousness on your part, you mean?
I think on both sides. I think.
But is are the stakes higher because they're fellow artists and you want their approval?
I think so. I think that, if I'm honest, that's probably absolutely the case. And I think that, but you're also interested to see their reaction. You want to know what it is that interests them about it. But yes, you don't want them to like sort of say, oh, that's a waste of time.
Well, just before I throw you briefly out to the floor, maybe the Duchess of Cornwall can be a postscript, but let's look at this image, because it's a fascinating work. It's very recent. Self-portrait, because the presence of the self in all portraiture is something we look for, and how artists depict themselves is obviously a fascinating and endlessly fascinating subject, particularly with that wonderful late Rembrandt show on at the moment. But this is a very... Well, sometimes a process-driven work, but it's what about technique, technology, codes of representation, I suppose, to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, the premise of this. So this is a jokey self-portrait, I suppose. It's the idea is it's quite unfinished and slightly abstract, but the idea is it's me coming out of a photo booth, having done a sort of sneaky self-portrait in the photo booth. I like the idea. Okay, so there's several things. Okay, so the main thing is, you know, the photo booth, at a time when we're suddenly self-portraiture is a sort of daily newspaper, you know, discussion subject, which it probably hasn't been ever before, really. I mean, everyone's so aware of and interested in the idea of representation. We touched on it before, but it is absolutely a fresh thing. As a result, the old-fashioned analog technology of the photo booth, which we all recognise very clearly and know what it does and what someone coming out of one has been doing, our kids won't know that because they won't exist in a few years' time. You know, so it's nice, as a little metaphor, you know, visual sort of, you know, metaphor of a particular activity, but also the idea is it's about the sort of rapidly evolving technology. My daughter took the picture with, you know, the phone camera. The other bit of fun is really just, I mean, the idea of, you know, portraits, basically, you try and get people not to be self-conscious to get to do a good portrait. So if you want, you know, that's the aim. People tend to come in self-conscious, but you gradually sort of try and sort of like, distract them enough to see them actually doing what they actually do and who they are. You can't do that with a self-portrait, whether you're doing it of yourself with a camera or... You know, as you know, Rembrandt would have done it in a mirror, you know, you're never not conscious of being looked at. And so this idea of any kind of detachment is obviously sort of phony, as is even if you've done it, you know, in the style maybe, you know, in the 20th century, the artist maybe took photos or had photos taken and chose one. You're still choosing which ones you think the image you're trying to put across. And so the whole thing is rests on a sort of, so basically, the idea of this is it's not even pretending to be anything other than a very, very posed image done from a photo. there's still that thing that painters, the painter versus photography thing. When I grew up, when I was starting to paint, you know, painting felt like it had lost the battle with photography. And painters would either, was a rear guard sort of reaction of, you know, I'm not going to have anything to do with the photography, sort of Lucian style. Or there were people who were using it, but maybe pretending they weren't. And so that's the other sort of reference. That's the reason for having the sort of word photos in there as well. It's just the idea of sort of the sort of relationship between painting and photography.
And Richter, the obliteration, yes, of the image, but also the resilience of painting.
Yeah, and the Richter, the man who vacillated between doing photorealist paintings, often portraits, and total abstracts, keeping his options open, but actually both brilliantly successful. And this, you're right, that's exactly the idea. There's a bit of both those styles going on in the picture. Anyway, actually, it would be terrible to ramble about your own self-portrait for hours, but I was trying to wrap several ideas, possibly too many, up in one image. So that's what's going on.
There's quite a lot of brevity, actually, in that answer on the self-portrait. It's amazing you thought you were going on. It's more the fact that the thing I wanted just to ask you finally was, you do look quite good there. It is quite a good picture. So when your daughter took this, did you think, oh, yeah, I don't look so bad there in the thing, and I'll use it? Or was it really... she did it not with prompting from you, but it because you were leaving a photo booth, it triggered those ideas.
We were on the lookout for doing this, because I had this idea in my head already. And I'd somehow thought I'd actually go and find one and set up and get someone pop to do it properly and do a really good one. And actually we just saw it, and I said, look, have a go. But yes, admittedly, she did take three, and I did choose the best one. When I sort of raised the idea of after the exhibition that it's in, which is up in Newcastle at the moment, finishing, it'd be a great one to have on the wall at home. My wife said, no way, that one, yeah, doesn't look like you at all. You're just obviously posing, trying to look good in a photo. So, I didn't really get away with that at all.
Watch this space. Other questions you'd like to ask, Johnny?
Jonathan, I've always been particularly fascinated by your portraits of famous people, of celebrities. And I wondered, you've got sort of an international reputation for this. Is there something particularly that attracts you to people who are well-known, and do you approach them? Do they approach you? If you approach them, I wondered how you choose an individual. And may I just say, regarding Berlusconi, I simply cannot wait to see your take on him. I wondered if you'd gone to the National Portrait Gallery to see the photograph of him at the Taylor Wessing exhibition, because this shows him as a malign, vacuous monster. And I just wondered if you'd seen that, if you'd like to comment.
I haven't seen that, so I can't comment, sadly. I will go and see it.
So relatively sympathetic, then.
I think he's got a sort of cheesy grin, and it's, you know, I think it's the sort of, you know, him getting away with it sort of look, more than the sort of terrible monster.
He does in the National Portrait. Right. He's got vacant eyes. It caused a scandal.
Yeah, great. Oh, have a look. Well,
but the issue of celebrity.
The celebrity, yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, celebrities are sort of, we have some mixed feelings even about the word of it these days. Obviously, I do a lot of paintings of a lot of different people, a lot of them time friends and family, but obviously the ones that people remember and write about tend to be the ones where we all know the subject. And so celebrities are the people we know in common. So they're usually the best ones to communicate whatever idea or stylistic thing or whatever you're trying to do. I've sort of got more used to doing the job. It's fun. And now I feel I'm sort of getting the hang of it now, to sort of do exhibitions where there's potentially a wide audience for the work. I think that's what it comes down to. So that's the reason for doing people who are well known, not all the time, but enough of the time that you can sort of do pictures which then, you know, people can talk about. How to choose them? It's partly opportunism. Sometimes you find yourself in a situation when you meet them or introduced to them by somebody else, and so that starts a conversation about it. Occasionally they approach me. Quite often these days I will just... if someone sort of keeps coming into my thoughts and sort of I can sort of start to sort of feel an idea about a picture, then that's a good reason to try and get in touch with them. I mean, and that's just a very unpredictable process. You know, sometimes there's a very easy way of getting hold of people... or you could, or they know your work already, and you can sort of, you know, make things happen quite quickly. Very often, it takes a very long time, or doesn't happen at all, or you know, there's no science to it at all. It's getting easier because I think, you know, I've obviously done enough work of other work that they've probably seen, or people they know that they can see very vaguely that it sort of, you know, at least might look like them. But it's not much more than that. I think it's a lot of the time it's just about making it actually happen. And the way I work is not so much needing people in the studio lots and lots and lots of times. I mean, obviously 3 or 4 times if they stay awake. But it's often about actually getting to know them outside, and so seeing them. You know, in the studio is, you know, an unusual, it's a strange alien environment. The sort of people aren't used to the sort of, you know, the lights, the smells, and having, you know, someone staring at them, drawing, taking photos, all that kind of thing. So it's partly about, you know, if necessary, I'll sometimes go and see people in their own space, and sometimes that's the most interesting way of doing it.
It's a very interesting answer, candid answer. David Bailey, who, when asked about celebrity, now just says, they're not celebrities, they're just people I know. But I suppose if you've been around for that long, then you tend to, then you develop the kind of reputation, then you become a kind of celebrity magnet. But the whole tradition of the National Portrait Gallery is a pantheon of interesting people, a kind of biography of national life. So I suppose you haven't painted that many celebrities in the purest sense of the word, people famous for being famous. They tend to be people who have a role in, I mean, they're famous artists, or they're politicians, or they're campaigners, or they're magnates, or whatever, actors.
Yeah, exactly. But I think you want to do pictures which are going to still be interesting, you know, as far in the future as possible. I mean, Grayson painted, I can't remember the guy's name, who's the reality TV star. Yeah. Precisely to make the point that these are the sort of transient celebrities of the time, and that works brilliantly now. But even that will be, you know, you'll have to explain to people in 10 years' time who that guy was. Maybe, yeah, I think it's, you know, you're just, you know, obviously you're hoping for immortality of some kind. You know, you're hoping that at least this sort of the work will live on through the subjects, if not through your own sort of vast reputation. So there's a bit of that, I think, that sort of drives the choice of subjects. But you also want ones that say something in some way about sort of society and what's going on now, and so a representative of something that interests you, whether it's politics or the kind of art that's going on, or sort of films you like. So I think it's all those things.
Immortality is a good thing. I mean, some of your sitters do just want peace and quiet and a bit of relaxation, but I think the idea that it may be a symbiotic relationship for some of your sitters, that you are immortalizing them, but at the same time they are a vehicle through which your reputation will be enhanced and extended, is a very potent one. Arturo Galanzino, who's the curator of the Moroni exhibition, had his hand up. Did you want to ask a question?
Yes. No.
Sorry.
First of all, one consideration. Thank you very much. It was great. I didn't expect when I decided to create this show that our talk would have been one on cut pieces, the other one, well, there was an actor disguised in a countess, and the third one we were talking about international politics, Nobel Prizes, bunga bunga. So I'm quite pleased because it means that art is a very various place, not for full of argument. No, but very interesting this conversation. My question is a little bit linked to the last question. Your question was about celebrity. My question is more about identity. Actually, to connect your work with what we have upstairs in the Moroni show, many of these portraits lost their identity for many reasons. One of the reasons, because Moroni had a kind of critical misfortune very soon, so these portraits were sold, misattributed sometimes to Titian, to Veronese, to other people, to other artists, and of course the sitter lost their own identity. How much is important identity in portraiture? How much this loss of identity could affect the work of Moroni, and in the future maybe the value, the strength of your work? This is because I see that what we have seen today is really linked with the identity of the sitter. Mm. George Bush, done with all these pornographic elements, makes sense because it's George Bush. He's 200 years, maybe after the atomic war. I don't know. Somebody will find your painting and, you know, They don't know who is the sitter. The value will change. The strength will change. If you have a consideration about that.
It's a very good, it's an interesting area that I think that a lot of, in a way, I feel what I do is sort of, it's the opposite end of portraiture from Lucian's approach, which was did everything in the same way, treated every part of the canvas equally and
flesh, democratically. Flesh, meat, animals,
yeah,
treated
it was
in the same way.
It was the surface of the world, including the cities. He was very rarely making eye contact with the subject. He wasn't really interested in making any sort of penetrating insights or any insights at all about them. It was mostly about him and what he saw. And he did that better than anyone who's ever painted before. Where he got the skin tones, it was unbelievable. It was mesmerizing. But you don't feel any of them really. You're finding out much about them. It is an interesting area. Grayson's conclusion, I think, on the sort of portraits and identity, was about that basically celebrity has become a proxy for the fact that we no longer have a little closed sort of society social group where everyone knows everyone. And so we're sort of like dealing with that by making some people common amongst all of us. And I'm not sure I quite agree with that, but I think it's a very interesting idea, and I think it does sort of link in with this. And funny enough, Moroni, of course, was partly ignored by art history from what I read quickly in the captions upstairs. Obviously, I was told not to prepare myself for this, but was partly geographically cut off from everything and was left out of Vasari's Lives of the Artists. Because of it, and therefore just in the days when there were very few people going around and checking out what was going on, these groups were isolated, and he was so the people in this picture may well have been very well known amongst that little sort of world, meant nothing at the time to anyone outside them. I like to think that hopefully someone, after the nuclear war, possibly started by some of the people we've just been looking at, will one day could look back and pick up the work individually and decode something about the personalities as well as, without needing to know the reputation of the person. I certainly think that the good ones are the ones where I managed to do both, is actually get some of the sort of actual sort of humanity, the personality of the subject, separate from their reputation. But take advantage of that reputation and the associations to have a bit of fun with as well.
It's the timeless idea for portraiture, isn't it? On one level, it's all art is culturally specific, and it's a document of the culture in which it's produced. But there is something, and it's often in the best art, it's unconsciously aspiring on behalf of the artist. But one wants to transcend one's time. And that, presumably with portraiture, on one level, very few of the greatest artists who've ever wielded a brush have been pure portrait painters, but many of the most broadly acknowledged achievements in Western art involve portraiture, and it's something to do with common humanity, isn't it?
Mm, exactly. Well, I think we are just instinctively set up to be more interested in faces, other human faces, than almost anything else we look at, possibly anything at all, because it's the thing that gives us so much information about things that we need to know right now. Who's this person who's walking towards me? What's their intention? Are they a threat? Are they a potential sexual partner, friend, enemy? How old are they? What are they thinking about right now? What's about to happen? This is these were survival instincts which we know. So we, and this all happens without us thinking. In a split second, we sort of read mostly certain parts, the eyes and the corners of the mouth, and a little bit more. Gradually it goes wider. It becomes less important. Actually, I think I saw that in Moroni too, is the fact that he's the selective focus around the picture. There's the face, it's always a couple of details of something very sharp in the clothes. It's sort of closer to our experience of seeing than actually happened in a lot of realist art later on once we got used to photography, which takes every part of the image. And so I think that's very interesting. But yes, you're right. There's this, most of the artists' reputations are sort of based on a recognisable style. Obviously, we don't believe Modigliani or Picasso were doing realist representations of the subjects, but you sense by looking through the work a bit of what was going on there. It's a tricky thing. I mean, that's the great conundrum. I mean, how much is it your personality and your thing, and how much are you channeling the person? That's the sort of perpetual challenge and timeless problem.
You touched a bit on technology, and that's becoming so, relevant in the art world right now, especially artists like Grayson Perry using to draw his pictures online and then sending it away to get the tapestries made. Do you see any opportunities for this in your work, and is that something you're interested in at all?
Using technology more.
Yeah.
I'd love to be able to sort of mass produce the work and spend fewer hours actually having to make it myself. I remember Damien one day when I was asking why it was taking so long to get the painting done. I said, well, you know, these things, you know, especially on this scale, take that much longer to paint. And you know, so, well, we just get people to do it for you. I mean, I've got some great painters at the moment. I'll send them around, and you know, they'll finish it in no time. Just give them the photo, they'll do it. And it's like, I love that. I love the logic of that. At the same time, the painters I like, I guess the people who like the sort of work I do with pretty the same boat, you're interested in why that person does it in a certain way. And I think it's quite hard to even train someone else to paint because you get them to see things in the same way and do the technique as well. It's very difficult. But yes, I mean, very great if we can use technology in other ways. I'm doing a print show, plug, next week, print retrospective on the South Bank. But doing editions is an interesting challenge because there needs to be a sort of, you know, a fairly quick way of doing them, and they need to all have a sort of consistency and but they also need to relate to the other end of the paintings, and so they have to be very intricately made. They have to get the same feel, and you also want each one to be different. And I'm still wrestling with how to make, you know, to give it that. At the moment, I'm generally doing it by adding bits on to the prints afterwards at the end before they go out, and so each one has something that's unique but also something that is part of the series. But I don't know. I don't know if my work would suit tapestries, but I'd love to find something like that.
20 seconds. Will you always remain a portrait painter?
Yes, in some way. I'm sure I'll veer away from it. I've tried collages, and I've done a lot of work that's still ongoing about plastic surgery and how we communicate and things people do to their faces, because I think it tells interesting things about our the way we live now. But I'll always come back to portraits.
You did a plug, quite right. It's your night. I'm going to do one. You were mentioning technology and artists sending work out to be made. We have a great Rembrandt show on at the moment, where Rembrandt is in some ways the essence really of the artist struggling with the human face, among other things. Next January at the Royal Academy, we have Rubens and Rubens' impact on art history and his legacy. And of course, the whole studio system with Rubens and the contractual arrangements of how Rubens and his assistants and his studio worked out who did what will be unravelled. And that also is a show curated by Arturo Galanzino, who's been very generous with Moroni because he's produced the first major Moroni retrospective outside of Italy ever. And Moroni is not an artist who's been widely known. And yet, as he says, with a certain generosity of spirit and a certain bemusement, he's managed to trigger all sorts of discussions about power politics, cod pieces and whatever. Anyway, feel free to go back to the Moroni exhibition. Feel free to grill Arturo about Moroni, but come and have a drink as well with Johnny and continue the conversation about Portia. Jonathan, thanks very much. It was always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you.